From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Here there be monsters. That's how ancient maps of the world labeled uncharted territories of ocean. And that's a good way to describe our show today. We'll explore the cultural history of monsters. Meet Justin Cronin, the author of one of this summer's hottest books called The Passage. Investigate the life and times of Bigfoot and look at Mary Shelley's classic novel Frankenstein. Also, cartoonist writer Linda Barry reminisces about some of her favorite monsters.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. Ah-hoo!
That's right, you heard me right, Kay. And the housewives, they all remark, it looks like a dirty marshmallow with fangs.
History shows again and again how naked whites sucked up the valley of men. Godzilla!
The monster's laughing maiden was clutched from where she lay and taken away to a hole down under the borders of the local bay by the creature from the Black Lagoon. I'm strange to see him back so
like a lot of supernatural baloney to me.
Supernatural, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not.
My name's Linda Barry, and I'm a writer and a cartoonist, and I live on a little farm in Wisconsin. And I've been in love with monsters ever since I was very little, when monsters were a little friendlier, actually. The monsters that I really liked were Frankenstein, and I liked The Mummy, even though I thought The Mummy was kind of a... I always felt that was one monster I would have no problem beating. I mean, he was slow, right? He was so slow you could run around and kick him in the behind and then still run in front of him. I always thought the way that you could trap the mummy, because, you know, you lay in, when you're a kid, you lay in bed thinking about how you'll fight monsters. I would always think that all you had to do was just put a whole bunch of wires, stretch across the floor, and then he'd trip and fall down and he couldn't get back up. But then I always think about people being kind of like monsters, like Dracula, who has no reflection. You know what I mean? And it's not that he has no reflection. He also doesn't have the ability to reflect, you know. I like the Wolfman because he knew he had problems. He's sort of like a... My husband and I, when we're grumpy, at least we know it, you know, and the moon's out and my fangs are about to grow, so you probably should leave right now. So I liked that a lot. But I liked thinking about these monsters that were like different states of mind. And the monster that I was obsessed with when I was a kid was the Gorgon or Medusa. I saw this film. There was a movie theater called The Barn when I was a kid, and it was really like a barn, and everybody would just drop off their kids, and then we'd sit through all the movies two or three times. And this movie, The Gorgon, scared me so bad because it was a lady who, if you looked at her, you turned into stone. But I guess in the movie that I saw, the way I remember it, is the guy saw her reflection. So he was turning to stone slowly, but he had enough time to write the story, like slowly turning into a stone. The climax of the movie is when she gets her head cut off, which terrified me, and especially because her head gets cut off and there are all these snakes and their head rolls for quite a while, which now, of course, I'd really enjoy. But I had a mom who was really, really temperamental, flew off the handle, really was scary, and she also hated eye contact. I really did have a mother that if I looked into her eyes, she saw that as an insult. And I didn't realize it until years later that my obsession with the Gorgon, I always say, helped me love my mother. That somebody with snakes for hair and eyes that could turn you into stone was the perfect monster for me. And, you know, I always like to ask people, what was theirs? What was yours? I think the last really good monster movie, my favorite of all time, and I don't know if you'd call it a monster movie, but it's Carrie, which is my absolute favorite. Whenever I'm depressed, I always put Carrie in and watch it, because there are times when you just really would like to stand in front of a bunch of people covered with blood and blow stuff up with your mind. So, yeah.
Linda Berry is a writer and cartoonist. She's the author of What It Is. Justin Cronin is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. His 2002 novel Mary and O'Neill won the Penn Hemingway Award, but Cronin's shifting gears with his latest novel, The Passage. The Passage has been described as an engrossingly horrific account of a post-apocalyptic America. So it may come as a surprise to learn that the genesis of the novel lies in conversations that Cronin had with his daughter, Iris, in 2006.
It happened in a sort of wonderful serendipity and also just a moment of parenting. My daughter, who was 8 at the time, came to me with concern that perhaps I was not living up to my potential as a writer. We were talking about books. She's a great reader, and we were just talking about good stories and bad stories, and she expressed the concern that perhaps my books were not interesting enough. And I said, okay, fine, Miss Smarty Pants, what should I write about? And she said, I think you should write a book about a girl who saves the world, and that it should be interesting, and that it should have a character, one character with red hair.
Is there any possibility that she has red hair?
You got that one right. Yeah, you don't even need to ask it. I took up this dare really just for fun. We spent about 3 months together, always in motion. We would do this when I was jogging at the end of the day, and she would follow along on her bicycle. I think the whole point of the exercise was actually to help her improve her bicycle riding skills. And we would float around my West Houston neighborhood spinning out a story with no expectations. I had no sense that I was ever going to write the thing. But it got good. It was what happened, really. Over the course of the 3 months, I began to feel that I was onto something. And when I hadn't taken any notes, and so at the end of the 3 months, when the weather got cold and the bike went into the garage, I decided that I would just type it up, you know, just so I wouldn't lose it. And I looked up 2 weeks later, it was right around Christmas time, and I had 30 pages of notes, a dense single-spaced document. What I knew at that point was that I certainly had a plot, but the question is, did I have a story? Came down to if the book had a voice, a way of telling itself. So I sat down to write a chapter, and it immediately gave itself up like that. And I was writing another book at the time. I had lots of other professional commitments. But I just started throwing things over the side of the boat as fast as I could to make way for writing this.
The Passage is almost 800 pages long, and it's the first book in a trilogy. Can you give me a quick overview of the storyline?
Boy, did I have to figure this one out, too, because for the first time anybody asked me that, I think my head burst, because it is a very, very big story with a cast of a lot of characters, and it has aspects of a horror novel and a vampire novel and a thriller and a Western and a coming-of-age novel and a war novel. It's got all these different types of books inside of it. Essentially, it is this. It is a story of before and after. The before is a series of events leading to something known as the Great Viral Cataclysm, which decimates the North American continent and probably the world, leaving behind about 40 million vampire-like creatures, extremely dangerous, almost impossible to kill, and nearly immortal, and very few human survivors. The after takes place about 100 years later, when a group of survivors, they're the descendants of children who were evacuated from Philadelphia in the last days of the war. These descendants make a journey across a dangerous North American continent from California to Colorado, led by a mysterious young girl who may hold the secret to saving humanity, the girl who saves the world that was requested by my own daughter.
Yeah. The monsters of this book, the vampires, as you call them, are actually vampires. They're referred to as virals, mostly, during the story. But in fact, are they vampires as we understand vampires from previous? Are they Bram Stoker vampires?
Here's the sort of the proposition of the book. Whenever you're working in an established storytelling tradition, like, say, vampire stories, you really got to make it your own. And when I decided that I would use vampires as the thing the little girl who saves the world would save the world from, what I thought was that I would have these be the real vampires, not the legendary vampires. Every legend is based on some kind of fact. I mean, no matter how you construe it, you know, King Arthur was not, you know, a handsome knight in shining armor. He was probably a pretty good local warlord in Cornwall who organized a group of other warlords to stave off the Anglo-Saxon invasion a few extra years. Every great legend begins somewhere. In fact, I decided that I would examine what the fact behind the legend might be. And I invented a character who was a paleo-virologist. I think this is an entirely invented profession, but I'm allowed to do that. I write fiction. Who goes searching for what he believes to be a virus existing in nature that has occasionally crossed over into the human community, producing, among other things, a spectacularly long lifespan, though with perhaps some unpleasant side effects that he would like to perhaps shake out of the mix.
Yeah.
And this is what's known as Project Noah at the start of the book, and of course it goes spectacularly wrong.
Yeah, you decided to have a kind of scientific origin to this, and that's your reason. You wanted this military experiment gone wrong to lead us to who knows where.
Yeah, I mean, science has been the magic of my lifetime. I'm not opposed to a little bit of magic in a novel or a short story, and I think in all my books there's a moment or two where that could be construed as either completely plausible, psychologically plausible, or perhaps the visit of a divine hand. But in this case, what I decided was I wanted to write about the real vampires. In my lifetime, of course, science has provided more than enough objects and events of starry-eyed wonder. That's the era in which I've grown up, and that is the magic of my life.
I want to get a sense of who these people, and they're based on people anyway, who they are, who the virals are. And there's a passage in the book I wondered if you'd read that describes one of them, Zero.
Oh, the main character that you're going to be hearing from here, not directly, it's not first person, but his thoughts, he's basically a janitor. Something was wrong with Subject Zero. For 6 days straight, he hadn't come out of the corner, not even to feed. He just kind of hung there, like some kind of giant insect. Gray could see him on the infrared, a glowing blob in the shadows. From time to time, he'd change positions a few feet to the left or right, but that was it, and Gray had never seen him actually do this. Gray would just lift his face from the monitor or leave containment to get a cup of coffee or sneak a smoke in the break room, and by the time he looked again, he'd find Zero hanging someplace else. Hanging? Sticking? Hell, levitating? No one had explained a goddamn thing to Gray, not one word, like, for starters, what Zero actually was. There were things about him that Gray would have said were sort of human, such as he had two arms and two legs. There was a head where a head should be, and ears and eyes and a mouth. He even had something like a Johnson dangling down there, a curled-up little seahorse of a thing. But that's where the similarities stopped. For instance, Subject Zero glowed. In the infrared, any heat source would do that, but the image of Subject Zero flared on the screen like a lit match, almost too bright to look at. Even his crap glowed. His hairless body, smooth and shiny as glass, looked coiled. That was the word Gray thought of, like the skin was stretched over lengths of coiled rope. And his eyes were the orange of highway cones. But the teeth were the worst. Every once in a while, Gray would hear a little tinkling sound on the audio and knew that it was the sound of one more tooth dropped from Zero's mouth to the cement. They rained down at the rate of half a dozen a day. These went into the incinerator, like everything else. It was one of Gray's jobs to sweep them up, and it gave him the shivers to see them, long as the little swords you'd get in a fancy drink. Just the thing if, say, you wanted to unzip a rabbit and empty it out in 2 seconds flat. There was something about him that was different than the others, too. Not that he looked all that different. The glow sticks were all a bunch of ugly bastards, and over the 6 months that Gray had been working on Level 4, he'd gotten used to their appearance. There were little differences, of course, that you could pick up if you looked hard. Number 6 was a little shorter than the others, number 9 a little more active, number 7 liked to eat hanging upside down and made a goddamn mess, number 1 was always chatting away that weird sound they made, a wet clicking from deep in their throats that reminded Gray of nothing.
There's something really almost like the vampires that you get in fiction, but there is this scientific basis. I guess it's your way of putting your own stamp on these.
Sure.
Vampires.
Yeah, I think that's every novelist's job. Anytime you sit down to write virtually any kind of novel, somebody has already been there first. You know, you're never really breaking entirely new ground. And it's our project, I think, as writers, is to be aware of that and to try to add to it. You're not inventing the wheel. You're improving the wheel. You're taking some ownership of the wheel. this was for me a kind of fun project to take every detail of legendary vampirism and find a way to explain it, to support it with some historical, biological fact, for instance, to give the creatures of the passage. And I call them creatures because the word vampire isn't, it's almost never used in the book. I mean, it's clearly there, but it's not used very often. They go by many other names. But to take all these qualities and to make them seem as if they could have really come from someplace. And I gave them a lot of attributes of other things in the animal kingdom. They have many attributes of birds or schools of fish, the way they move. They have a single biological event inside their bodies which explains their condition. Essentially, their thymus gland has been turned back on as this very mysterious organ located between your trachea and your breastbone that has something to do with healing and with the manufacture of T cells, but it's actually very poorly understood. So that every detail of the legend I tried to couch in some kind of scientific terms.
Did you worry about this at the beginning? Because vampires are all over the place these days. The Twilight novels, the HBO series True Blood. You had to have wondered, I mean, you could have created something else instead of the vampire. But the vampire or the virals, whatever name you use, they're a huge part of our modern zeitgeist, aren't they?
Yeah, I call it the vampire industrial complex. Obviously, there's a sense that vampires are the monsters of the moment. But I actually started this book before that happened. The fall that Iris and I had these conversations, that was about the same time that the first Stephanie Meyer's book came out. And of course, she's the big driver of this. But it took a couple of years to build. So when we were first fashioning the story and when I began to write, the template and the experience of vampirism that I was operating out of were really the vampire stories of my own youth, yeah. With things like Dark Shadows, and which I watched every afternoon after school at 3:30.
And from there to Buffy, sure.
If I had written this book 10 years ago, everybody would be saying, well, what does this have in common with Buffy the Vampire Slayer? They've never gone away. There's always the vampire story that we are engaging with, or the next one that we're ready to engage with. They've never gone away.
Do you think it's the immortality that is at the root of our interest in them?
Yeah, I think that's true. A lot of people say that it's a narrative basically of seduction, and it is. There's no question about that. But for me, the strongest part of that story is its exploration of the question, what part of your humanity would you be trading away were you to become immortal? In other words, how much of the sweetness and richness of being alive and being a human being is dependent upon the fact that it's finite? And I think that's a question we ask ourselves many times in our lives, and really in two distinct places. I think young people making the transition from the sort of the immortal state of being young. I mean, when you're young, you really feel like you're going to live forever. And then one day, all of a sudden, you realize that you're getting all these new privileges and things. You can drive, you can get a job, you can have your own money. But what comes with this, of course, is a lot of burdens. All of a sudden you have to be responsible and you have to pay your bills. And that's a moment, I think, when people encounter this question. And then I think later on in life we encounter this question when you realize that the journey of your life is, say, well down the road, and you realize that you're not waiting for your life to start, it already has. Yeah. And you've accumulated a lot of experience, and you realize, oh, this is my life, it will end someday. And I think it's a question we all wrestle with, even when, of course, the answer is obvious. But nevertheless, we have to face it.
Justin Cronin is the author of The Passage. You can find a link to Cronin's website on our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, we'll explore the cultural history of monsters and investigate the life and times of the legendary Bigfoot as we continue our hour on monsters. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Stephen Asma is a philosophy professor at Columbia College in Chicago. He's also the author of several books. including On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. He talked to Anne Strangeships.
Many people know the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, but I was actually in the Hunterian Museum in London, and they have just jar after jar of these sort of all the ways that nature can go wrong. And this kid is there with his mother. He's having this completely disturbing experience. He's looking at them. He's sort of gasping out loud. And the mother says, you know, should we leave? And he says, absolutely not. You know, he wants to stay and, you know, enjoy.
This is why we have horror movies.
Right, exactly.
So why is it that we enjoy scaring ourselves silly with monsters?
There's a few theories on this, and I look at some of them in the book. I mean, one of the ones that I think a lot of people are familiar with is sort of the Freudian idea that we all have these kind of id-like urges and instincts in us, and there's something about monster stories that allows us a kind of catharsis, and we can let these kind of, you know, let these demons inside us off their chain. They can howl at the moon a little bit, and then we can go on with our lives of quiet repression. So that theory, I think, is well known. But one that I think is more interesting in a way and kind of something that neuroscience and cognitive scientists are sort of developing is that there seems to be some arousal and fear kinds of responses when you have cognitive mismatch. So when things don't quite make sense to your cognitive brain, and monsters frequently do this, they're kind of hybrid creatures, mixes of this animal and that animal, then it produces this kind of interesting arousal in us. So there's something that's sort of repugnant and attractive at the same time because there's some disconnect between these parts of the brain.
Mm. Of course, some of the most interesting things you look at about monsters are really what social and cultural functions they've served for us. You know, for instance, if thinking about the world of ancient Greek mythology, you know, in Greek myths, the job description of a hero always seems to be someone who goes off to fight monsters. They're always going off to kill gorgons and hydras and minotaurs. So the monster seems to have functioned in that culture as a kind of test of strength.
I think that's right. And you see sort of two things going on there. One is you see a culture oftentimes demonizing another culture, which is fairly common human behavior. For the ancient Greeks and Romans, they had this view that many species of monsters lived somewhere in India. They had a very strange sense of geography, but you could think about people in foreign places as not just barbaric, but also as subhuman. And then on top of it came this idea that, well, we have warriors who can protect us. So it was an opportunity for manliness to express itself as, you know, we're going to go out there, slay the monsters, and restore security and stability to our community. So that was a common theme in the monster stories.
Hmm. Moving forward, there are monsters in the Bible, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of monsters in the Bible. And it's interesting. If you look at the Bible, you'll find the classic monsters of the Old Testament, something like Behemoth, for example. But then in the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse, you'll find a whole new bevy of dragons and creatures. In addition to this, the patristic, the sort of church fathers, had this whole ancient tradition of monsters. There was a belief in the Cynocephali, for example, which were men who actually went around with dogs' heads. They were like men, but their heads were dogs, and they barked instead of speaking. Then there was also the Blemmii, which were headless creatures, and their mouths and eyes appeared right in the center of their chest. So there's all this great stuff that St. Augustine is trying to sort of analyze and say, well, where does this fit in God's plan? So you see him wringing his hands. Are these humans? Will they be capable of redemption? Should we try to baptize them? So the church and the medieval period was very interested in monsters. Why did God make them? Oftentimes the giants are discussed, and the argument there was the giants must be there to serve a purpose, and the purpose must be God is trying to tell us not to be arrogant and puffed up like the giants because that will make us fall. So this kind of stuff, the morality tales.
Speaking of those dog-headed people or demons, there's a drawing you made in your book of, I think it's a dog-headed saint that was worshipped?
Yeah, that's right. People know St. Christopher from, he basically in the Roman church, he carries Christ across the river. And what people don't know is that there's this Eastern Orthodox version of the saint who is, in fact, a member of the Cynocephali species, a dog-headed man. And the story there is that he basically comes from this barbaric culture But he hears the good news. He learns about Christianity and Jesus. He converts, and then he gets the gift of human speech. And then he goes around basically converting people. And the authorities try to kill him right and left, and he becomes this martyr. Yeah, it's a great marriage of the sort of Christian saint tradition and the monster tradition.
Well, an example of taming the beast, I suppose, converting
yeah,
the monster.
Right. Yeah, and it shows you that, see, the monsters, they have potential. They, you know, if, as long as they can be converted, you know, we'll be all right.
But this must have posed a theological dilemma for the early church fathers. If a benevolent God created the world, why on earth would God have created monsters to prey on his creation?
Yeah, it's a great question. Before the Christian view of God, the ancient Greeks, like Aristotle, for example, he thought, well, what happens with a monster is the monster is a combination of form and matter. So the form is perfect, but the matter messes up. And when the form replicates, it makes a monster. So even though you've had this strange offspring, it was supposed to be a human being. And it's just that matter got sort of confused things. But in the Christian paradigm, God makes everything, including matter. So you have this additional problem. Why would God make these evil creatures? What is the point of that? And so it becomes this sort of, you know, the old problem of evil. Why would God allow the monsters to persecute? And when you get to the medieval period, of course, the monsters, they sort of shift from being these natural history monsters in the another part of the world and become the ones we're more familiar with, the demons, the witches, that which possesses us, gets into us like a ghost. And the argument there is the reason why God has created these or allowed these to manipulate people is because human beings, by their immoral activity, deserve this. And that's generally the theological explanation, that you become a witch because your immoral behavior called them down, and this is your own punishment. So that's kind of the argument that's given.
That's fascinating. I hear running underneath everything we've discussed so far the suggestion that the real monsters are us and our works, our creations, and that the monster stories we tell ourselves are complex ways of working out the things that horrify ourselves about ourselves.
I think that's right. If you look at the narratives that we love, even the stuff that people are really into now, vampires, zombies, you do see that the culture is working through some of these fears and anxieties and vulnerabilities that we have. And oftentimes you see that they end with these kind of resolutions that return us to some sense of security. So I do think they're having a kind of social psychological impact.
Near the end of your book, you begin to explore human monsters, serial killers, terrorists. Seems as though you're really redefining what exactly a monster is at this point. You know, it's not just a creepy creature or a demon that might possess someone. It can be a friend, a neighbor. Everyone has the potential to become monstrous.
I think that's right. I think it's not so much that I'm redefining it, but the culture has redefined it in this way. It's interesting, when I was working on this book, I punched in one of these Google search terms, and it will return the appearance of, you know, this term anywhere in the news, you know, and you'll get it once a day. And I just typed in, I said, give me back news articles that use the word monster. And every day, the newspapers are filled. And if you haven't sort of noticed this, take a look and you'll see how many times monster is used to describe the criminals in the news that we're sort of experiencing on a daily basis. So this idea of moral monsters is very much with us. And I understand partly what's happening in modern culture is we're coming to understand psychopathology better. At the same time, I think some people run so far afoul of the line that we have no other language by which to sort of characterize them. And so we reach into our bag of terms and concepts, and monster seems to fit. So it's still doing some work, even in the here and now.
I'm curious what you make of the recent spate of movies and books in which it seems as though we're taming or reworking some of our oldest monsters. You know, vampires are becoming simply lovelorn teenagers, and werewolves are the nice adolescent boys next door. Is this kind of an inevitable process, or what's going on?
Yeah, that's interesting. I talk about an older version of this where the monster Grendel gets sort of tamed in the Christian tradition, you know, the old Beowulf story is very much that the monster Grendel is just evil and you have to kill it and it's just that's the end of the story, full stop. But as you progress along and you get a more liberal culture, I mean small l, tolerant culture, then the monsters get recreated as being not quite as insidious as we thought they were. And, you know, I think about this, you know, your example of the vampires. And if you think about vampires, they're sort of the aristocrat monsters. You know, they're frequently very intelligent. They're good looking. They're sexually attractive. This is also part of the original story, too, if you look at Polidori's vampire. They're almost like you want to be these people. But then again, they live forever and they drink blood. And, you know, so it's sort of like it's that attraction repulsion. You're attracted to them, but at the same time, their monster status is an abnegation of their humanity. So it's almost like you can imagine here's this debonair cad that you're highly attracted to, but watch out, he's going to break your heart. So that's like, that's happening in these stories. I think of zombies as being like the proletariat of monsters because, you know, they're just, they're not attractive. They're not aristocratic. They're just like the workers with a brainstem left and we're all going to end up like this. And there's something sort of funny going on here. I'm not sure how to get to the bottom of it, but it's definitely communicating something about our culture. And I do think there is a general tendency to want to lend greater humanity to the monsters. That's the story of becoming increasingly liberal. So that's my own take.
Well, my last question, I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to say in answer to it, but do we need monsters?
Oh, yes. I'm sure you knew that was coming. I think we do. Yeah, I don't think they're ever going to go away. As soon as you shine a light in this area, because I basically did a kind of a history of monsters, and that's what happens is you shine a light into an area, and then basically interest in monsters retreats to another area of human endeavor. And it seems to be that that's going to be a constant issue because human beings are, as far as I can tell, are always going to be vulnerable, and that's what monsters are about.
Stephen Asma is the author of On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. He spoke with Anstrange Champs. Joshua Blue Buse is an independent scholar and the author of Bigfoot, The Life and Times of a Legend. He told Steve Paulson why he wrote a book about Bigfoot, even though he doesn't believe the creature exists.
It's interesting to me that there's this thing, this idea of Bigfoot that we could all talk about, we could all reference, and it immediately evokes certain images in our head, so that while Bigfoot may not exist as a creature running through the forests of the Pacific Northwest, there's no doubt that Bigfoot exists as a thing in our culture.
How far back does the legend of Bigfoot go?
Depending on how broadly you want to define the subject, you could find wild men creatures in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the first written story we have. People who are more partisan about Bigfoot might trace it back to Native American tales, mythologies, and legends that also talk about these half-human, half-beast creatures. In my opinion, you don't really start getting Bigfoot as we know him, really until the 1950s.
Well, it's fascinating to think that this legend, I mean, this thing that we all know about, suddenly exploded in popularity, I guess you would say, in the 1950s. So how do you explain that?
That was one of the things that really drew me to this story, because when I first came to it, my full expectation would be that I would be kind of steeping myself in Native American legendary. When I looked at the story, there wasn't that connection there at all. And so what it seems to me, if I could do a quick gloss on it, you had the story come out of Northern California that there was a creature that they were calling Bigfoot rummaging around construction sites. And the story got a little bit of local play, but then was picked up by the newswires in October of 1958 and rocketed around the world, and was a momentary story. It was kind of a flash in the pan at the time, but it was interesting. But then it got picked up by what were at the time called men's adventure magazines. And these were magazines such as Argosy and True and Men and Male that catered to a primarily working class male audience. And for various reasons, the stories about Bigfoot were appealing to this audience and could be shaped to fit into these magazines. And so then became kind of a constant presence throughout the late 1950s and 1960s in these magazines, and then was picked up again in the 1970s in another new form of communication. This was what was called four-walling movies.
What are four-walling movies?
Four-walling movies. This was an innovation in movie techniques done in the early 1970s by a number of primarily Western-based small independent film companies. And what they saw was that rural audiences were not being catered to by Hollywood, and so they decided to start making their own movies, and then they would show them in Elks clubs or in local theaters if they were high schools, and they would rent the whole theater when there was a theater. So they were renting all four walls, as it were, and so they became christened four-wallers.
Hmm. So going back to the 1950s, when magazines started writing these remarkable tales of Bigfoot, does raise the question of whether these magazine editors actually believed the stories of Bigfoot, or was it just a way to sell more copies?
It's pretty clear now it was entirely to sell more copies. These magazines were very ardent in that they presented themselves as true and as authentic, and these were true stories. As a number of the people who worked on these magazines have since admitted, the stories were invented whole cloth. They invented stories about World War II. There was never any concern for authenticity.
It almost sounds like you're saying that the magazines are what created the Bigfoot phenomenon, at least in this country.
I think the magazines are, in a lot of ways, what perpetuated it and brought it to popular consciousness, yes. If you hadn't had this kind of magazine system, it strikes me that it's very unlikely that the story would have ever jumped out from a small local story to become something nationwide. As it is, we have a lot of monsters, local lore about monsters all across the country, but it's Bigfoot that is, as one book put it, America's number one monster. It's the monster that we all know about.
Hmm. You also write that Bigfoot's popularity really took off in the 1960s and 70s, and it was especially popular among white working class men. How do you explain that?
What I think was happening is that the stories about Bigfoot, as they were being told in a lot of the men's magazines that were popular at the time and in some of the independent films that were being produced at the time, these stories ended up reflecting on certain experiences that white working class men were having, and so that they could both see Bigfoot as a symbol of themselves, in that here was a creature that was feeling attacked and maybe near extinct and was a holdover from an older time, which sometimes they felt themselves to be at a time when there were protests over the Vietnam War, when the civil rights activities were so momentous, that they could see themselves as Bigfoot, as a creature from another time that was a holdover and that was being circumscribed by the world. And at other times they could see the Bigfoot as the aggressor, as the thing that was attacking them. There is an unfortunate history in this country of linking apes to African Americans, and this was also occurred in the Bigfoot literature, where you would see Bigfoot sometimes likened to African Americans. And as I said, the stories reflected a lot of their experiences.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have spent a fair amount of time with members of the Bigfoot community. Were there any particular people who you found especially interesting?
I don't know that I'm 100% comfortable answering that question.
Without giving details, why? I'm curious.
The book's reception among the Bigfoot community has been, I mean, some of the people are interesting, but not always in ways that I appreciate.
They've gotten kind of angry at you for saying that Bigfoot doesn't exist.
Yes. One gentleman in particular has taken to the internet and claims that my book is a literary fraud. And in a way, he kind of ended up accidentally supporting my hypothesis, because one of his attempts to really knock me down was to claim that I was gay, which kind of goes to show that, yeah, interest in Bigfoot is tightly correlated with anxieties about masculinity.
Wow. So things are kind of dicey out there. You have to be a little careful about what you say.
The Bigfoot community is hard to call it a community. It's very riven by a lot of tensions. You do have to weigh what you're saying and know which audience you're speaking to. And yeah, Bigfooters hold grudges for a long time.
Now, has the nature of the reported sightings changed over the decades? I mean, is the Bigfoot that we hear about today more or less the same as the Bigfoot that was reported back in the 1950s?
No, and I think this might actually go back to one of your earlier questions. What you'll see in the 1970s depictions of Bigfoot, especially Bigfoot was a rampaging monster that would attack people. Many of the more recent, I guess you would say, reports about Bigfoot are actually about its docility and about the fact that some families have been able to keep Bigfoot tribes, I guess for lack of a better word, Bigfoot groups under observation for a long time and have been able to communicate with the beast, and so that the creature becomes more of a gentle giant than it used to be.
How do you account for that?
Well, I think part of that is kind of piping Bigfoot through environmentalism, where Bigfoot now in a lot of ways stands in for a concern about the environment. And I think in the 1980s especially, you'll see Bigfoot had gotten picked up into a lot of much more middle class publications. The example being Harry and the Hendersons, where Bigfoot was very much tamed. And so you have a new kind of mass media vision of what Bigfoot is. And so then we tell ourselves stories about Bigfoot that are different. And so if you have a gentle giant, if you have a defender of the earth, then that creature needs to be approached differently than if you had a monster held over from primeval times looking to scrape by.
Do you think Bigfoot is with us for years to come, decades to come?
I think in one form or another, Bigfoot will continue to be with us for quite some time, yes. The creature exists right on the edge of the things that we know and we don't know, and there's always going to be something that we don't know. I think it's even possible, maybe speculative, but possible to kind of project the image forward and see it in alien life forms. If you imagine one day we're exploring another planet, Mars, say, and I have a strong sense that we're going to hear stories that there's just beyond the edge of vision, that there's some creature that the first explorers have seen, and these stories are going to come back to us, and they're going to be much like Bigfoot, and that maybe we'll find what look like footprints in the red dust of Mars. And so I think that you'll always have something like this Bigfoot creature with us, yes.
Joshua Blue Buse is the author of Bigfoot, The Life and Times of a Legend. Why do you think Bigfoot's America's number one monster? And what purpose do you think our fascination with monsters serves? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, Richard Holmes on Mary Shelley's classic novel Frankenstein as we conclude our Hour on Monsters. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Richard Holmes is the author of The Age of Wonder, How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science. In a chapter called Dr. Frankenstein and the Soul, Holmes explores how Mary Shelley's 1818 novel Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus, came out of the scientific climate at the time. Holmes sketched out the cultural cross-currents for Steve Paulson.
There's also evidence that Mary Shelley attended and read the lectures of Humphrey Davy. And here's a very characteristic mixture, because Humphrey Davy, the great chemist, is another important figure in the book. And he gives lectures describing the great breakthroughs in electrical theory and chemistry and putting forward the notion that progress would be unstoppable, and particularly the discovery of electrical power would lead to completely new kinds of experiments, and mankind would dominate the material world in a completely new way. These lectures, they are very extraordinary. They're published, they're still available. Mary read them, and there's some evidence that Davy himself is also one of the models for the fictional Victor Frankenstein. Mm. So Mary explores these ideas of vitalism. Victor Frankenstein is trained as a physician and a chemist, and gradually has this idea that if he can produce, like a manufacture, a human life, then it might be possible, and his idea is progressive. It's meant to benefit mankind. It's often forgotten this, that once you do this, the possibilities of curing all kinds of disease and bringing back people who are diseased but also dead, this opens up a whole new field which will benefit mankind. So Victor Frankenstein initially is meant to be a benevolent figure, often forgotten this. Mm-hmm. But Mary then goes on to explore the implications of he actually produces the creature, as the monster is called in the novel. And a very interesting imaginative shift. She says, okay, we'll assume the science, but what is the nature of this creature that has been produced by artificial means?
I guess the question is, does Frankenstein's creature have a soul?
That's exactly it. And I think this is an absolutely central theme of the novel, and I explore this at some length. And Mary is quite extraordinary, the way she... I mean, this is a very good example of an imaginative writer getting hold of a scientific theme and then turning it upside down, looking at it, exploring its implications. If you read the novel carefully, when the creature breaks out of the laboratory and goes into the woods, it's very carefully described by Mary that he has no memory, he has no language. It's a wonderful passage where he, in the woods at night, he looks up at the moon and he doesn't have a word to name the moon. And he sees this very beautiful object, but he has no language, he's learnt no language.
I started up and beheld a radiant form rise from among the trees. I gazed with a kind of wonder. It moved slowly, but it enlightened my path, and I again went out in search of berries. I was still cold when under one of the trees I found a huge cloak, with which I covered myself and sat down upon the ground. No distinct ideas occupied my mind. All was confused. I felt light and hunger and thirst and darkness. Innumerable sounds rang in my ears, and on all sides various scents saluted me. Sometimes I tried to imitate the pleasant songs of the birds, but was unable. Sometimes I wished to express my sensations in my own mode, but the uncouth and inarticulate sounds which broke from me frightened me into silence again.
And he listens to the sounds of birds in the morning, and he thinks, there's a language, could I learn that language? So actually, the study of the monster is the study of a soul, as it were, coming awake. And gradually, through a very skillful part of the plotting, the monster learns about human history. It does indeed learn language and so on, concepts of war. But because he's a reject from society, because he's an artificial creation, he is very cruelly, first of all, handled by people because he's so ugly. And then he, in turn, becomes cruel and vengeful. And this is Mary exploring the idea of a human being who doesn't have a soul, or not a soul as we would recognize it. So there is a theological text underneath that book, as well as a whole series of scientific ideas that are brilliantly explored.
Hmm. Why do you think the story of Frankenstein has proved to be so enduring?
Good question. Very interesting. That book, when it was published in 1818, it only was published in 500 copies. It was almost unknown as a work. It was thought possibly it was written by Walter Scott or indeed by Shelley himself. Very interesting. The idea that an 18-year-old woman could have written it was inconceivable. And how she came to write it itself is a very interesting literary question, someone that young. But that first edition of the novel had almost no readership. But what happened while Mary was still out in Italy, in fact, after Shelley drowned, the theatre world in London got hold of it. And it became the text for a series of theatrical productions. And I've traced there were 5 separate productions of Frankenstein, or Presumption was one of the subtitles. These productions were put on all over England, and indeed they came to America, to New York. And that is what initially popularized the book. But in turning it into a play, a lot of the philosophical implications are dumped, and it becomes something much closer to the modern film versions. And for example, I've talked about the monster, the creature learning human language as part of becoming a soul in some sense. In the dramatic productions, he has no language. He cannot speak. And you can see in imaginative terms, this totally transforms the story, because in the novel, we are inside the creature's mind and we suffer with him. And indeed, he's the most articulate person in the whole novel. His speeches are wonderful, almost operatic. But in the theatrical versions and subsequently in the modern film versions, he has no language, he does not speak. So he simply becomes a monster. And this is the modern version of the threat of science. Science will always produce monsters. And in a way, it's a great distortion of the original novel, because the idea initially was to do something benevolent that would benefit mankind. And that idea completely drops from modern interpretations of Frankenstein. And I think, therefore, it's haunted people in a modern world where there is still great fear of the effects of science. I think the Two Cultures lecture by C.P. Snow, given in 1959, I think that was partly inspired by the terror that nuclear weapons had produced. And this alienated a scientific culture from a more humane and literary one. I think this has completely changed now with problems of climate change and energy resources and so on. But I think that fear that science was always going to produce monsters, it would promise benefits, but it would produce monsters, runs very deep in Western culture. But we need to get over it.
Richard Holmes is the author of The Age of Wonder, How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 725A, Monsters. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.